Morning. One of the reasons that we're waiting, I can put this air dribbled coffee down. Pants. I'm just waiting for that to dry, but I can actually walk around like this right now. Scott guaranteed me that I got the right color pants on because it's not going to show. All right. So
I can't see through that.
A good message up here in terms of what we're going to talk about today. And I want to talk to you about one thing that I feel in terms of policy with staff. And it comes out of an AWC report called Citizens Survey across. They claim, we can certainly know this as we work in this business called city management, is that two major colliding and probably in state. First one that we're dealing with is that we have a shrinking amount of revenue that today in most cities across the state, and we have barely enough revenue to cover just basic services. Basic services require from down to our streets we'll see every day. We all come from. I'll talk specifically about Kirkland. We pride ourselves in the kind of parks we provide for our citizens, and that's an expected basic service. So we barely have enough money in most cities now to cover those, let alone other priorities that citizens have and that things that we would like to do. The other issue that's colliding with that is that as an aging state, as an aging city, we have infrastructure underneath the ground that is seriously being challenged. And these are big projects. These are expensive projects. In many cases, we haven't put enough away in reserves or in the fees for service to be able to pay for new services or new expanded services or improved pipes and infrastructure that need repairing and replacing in today's dollars. We are now looking at estimating about 50% or more of what's underneath the ground as being seriously challenged and needing some form of repair now or replacement now or certainly in the future. And we don't have the funds for those kinds of endeavors. That's a real worry at the state level and certainly in every city like a town that's 100 years old like Kirkland. You combine with that the fact that 1975, about 50% of us lived in large metropolitan areas. Today, that figure is up to 60% and a little bit beyond. Much of this is done by annexation, but the message there is that more and more of us have come into large metropolitan areas and using services. I always joke with people that if we get Park Place expanded and we have 4,000 more people there, that probably don't want them all flushing the toilet at the same time because that probably won't work, right? People in public areas. So, but we're lucky with that project, they're going to be paying for a lot of the new infrastructure. So we will make progress when new facilities come online through development. I look back on the area of trees, which is another thing I want to quickly touch on, is that, and this is dated, memorable date, 6/17 and 02, June 17th, good date. Sent it to Eric Shields. I was new on the council back then, I was 6 months on the council, and I wanted to initiate a tree ordinance. And so I was doing a lot of work on the site. Every other day I'd send Eric another one. This was called Economic Benefits of Maintaining a Treed Canopy. We had everybody in a panic because tree ordinances were really hard to do at that time in towns around this area. Mercer Island had a terrible time with one, and the legal aspects, the business community, the development community didn't want to do this. But we did do it. It took a couple of years and a lot of work, and we have, I think, a very progressive, workable tree ordinance. Didn't get everything that we wanted, you never do. But it's something, it is workable. And what I had listed in this is, yes, I think I'm telling Erickson and Paul, they already knew all this stuff, you know, that mature trees can easily control over $50,000 in pollution in their lifetime. I don't know how we measured that, but that's a good figure. Trees reduce the electrical usage for air conditioning and for heating in the winter. Trees can store an enormous amount of water, so it helps filtrate into our storm sewers. So what we're going to talk about today are things that we can begin to implement that future generations will have the benefit wise decisions today that won't put them in the same place as we are today from maybe less than wise decisions on how we plan our underground super infrastructure in the past. So do you want a copy of this now, Eric? I printed this. About to beg your pardon?
I'm not as good at keeping my records as you are.
Oh, it's not on the computer. But see, I ran it off on old paper. I have this endless supply of city paper. But, yeah, I could say, oh my gosh, this is the East Side Human Service Forum's budget. Why'd I bring this for? Enjoy. And kudos to the Green Team and Brenda Nunes. This is probably one of the best series of seminars and forums that we've done in the city. Thank you very much for all your work, everybody.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Well, welcome again to our third in a series of sustainable site and the heat island effect. I wanted to just really quickly introduce the speakers. I'm going to be the moderator today. Stacy Rush from Public Works Department down there is going to speak today. Deb Powers from City of Kirkland, Urban Forester. Matt Miller from AES is going to speak today. And David Hilgers from Triad and Associates. As always, we want to thank our partners and sponsors. Today we're lucky enough to have Vicki Colgan here from the Department of Ecology. She's up front. And they've helped, along with the Sustainability Foundation and Brenda Nunes, to partner and sponsor this event. And we really thank them for all their support. So, just real quick, what today's agenda is, we're going to go over the following items. What is the heat island effect? It's not something that just happens when you go to Hawaii. How is our development of the built environment influencing it? So we're going to have lots of examples from the different speakers that talk about that. We're going to be looking at what are the strategies and the synergies to combat it. Sometimes there's some things you can do to reduce the heat island effect, and it also has a positive impact on stormwater infiltration. So we're going to be talking about those things. And during the whole thing and after and so forth, please be thinking about what is your role in this subject matter? Where do you fit in? One of the things I was thinking about last night was, you know, when you're at a counter and you're talking to a client or an applicant, having this knowledge is really important. It also helps you to point to other professionals that can help them solve some of the environmental problems that we have. And oftentimes, you know, just making that first contact with somebody and describing some of our sustainability efforts here, for example, that may be the first time somebody hears about the subject matter, and it helps them to want to learn more. And even if you don't know much about the subject matter, if you know who to point to in the Green Team, we're all kind of intersecting in the sustainability realm, whether we know it or not. So just be kind of thinking about that. If you're writing codes, you know, reviewing permits, having pre-submittal meetings, you know, and if, obviously if you're in the development community, asking us the questions, how do we do more sustainable development, or telling us you could do it better this way. We're open to listening to suggestions. Some of the speakers are going to refer to is a LEED program and the Built Green program. There's also a few other references. If you actually go to those websites, you'll see that some of the certification programs out there actually help explain what the heat island effect is and what kind of strategies, and also it basically you are rewarded for reducing the heat island effect. Our first speaker is going to be Stacy Rush. And if I can have you limit the questions, we have a lot of slides and a lot of material to get through today. And it's okay to ask a question, but we're going to try to have like close to a half an hour at the end to answer questions for the panel. If you want to.
Okay, I'm not used to wearing a microphone. Usually I'm pretty loud on my own.
Go a little higher.
Okay, is that, can you hear me? Can you hear me now? Okay. Good morning. I'm Stacy Rush, and I'm a stormwater engineer for the City of Kirkland in the Public Works Department. I'm also on the Green Building team with David. And you may not have heard this term before, heat island effect, but I'm sure you've all felt it. If you go out in the summertime, if you're not wearing shoes, and you walk on the pavement or the sidewalk, you can feel that it's hotter than if you step off the sidewalk onto the grass. You'll feel the difference. That's kind of heat island effect. And I was thinking about this last night. It's not something new that has just happened. I remember, like 30 years ago or so when I was a little kid, I lived in the suburbs outside of Washington, D.C., and we used to go out and pop the tar bubbles out in the street along the asphalt. See, you're nodding. See, I'm not the only one. But I started thinking about that. It's like, I don't see tar bubbles anymore. But maybe that was, they do something different with the tar now or something. But I think that was before bubble wrap, because we didn't have that back in the 70s. But it used to drive my mom crazy, because I'd come in and I'd have tar and oil all over my fingernails and all over my clothes. And I'm sure she wasn't crazy about us playing in the street all the time, but it was a cul-de-sac, so it was fine. But that's kind of heat island effect. And you may also not know some of the detrimental things that happen to the environment from heat island effect. So I've already kind of talked. What it is developed areas, the areas that were once permeable with vegetation and moist, then they become impermeable and dry. That's the hard surfaces. And so this change causes urban areas to become warmer than the rural surroundings. So that's kind of what that little red line is showing, how it's much hotter in the city areas as opposed to the adjacent rural areas. And you also have, you can have a heat island effect on both the on the surface and in the air. And these figures I've gotten through all of my presentation are from EPA, and surface heat islands, so we're talking about with the heat on the surface, those are typically highest during the day because the exposed hard surfaces radiate that heat much higher than the air temperature, while shaded and vegetation surfaces remain close to air temperature. And you can have some pretty different, or some pretty significant increases between the surface temperature in a developed area and a surface temperature in a rural area. You're looking at between 18 and 27 degrees during the day and 9 to 18 degrees Fahrenheit at night. And then you switch to the atmospheric heat islands, so the air temperature, it's only about 1 to 5 degrees during the day, but at night it's 12 to 21 degrees. And you probably noticed that in the city it's hotter at night because the developed areas do not cool down like they do in the rural areas. So then you think, well, you know, why is it bad that it's a little warmer in the cities? Is that such a bad thing? Well, elevated temperatures from urban heat islands, particularly during the summer, can adversely affect your environment and your quality of life. One of the big things is the effect on stormwater. Hot pavement and rooftop surfaces, they transfer that excess heat to the stormwater when it rains. There's been field measurements from EPA that show that runoff from urban areas is 20 to 30 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than runoff from a typical rural area. That's when the pavement temperatures are about 20 to 35 degrees hotter. So 20 to 30 degrees, that's a significant amount. And granted, I think a lot of these numbers from the EPA are done maybe on East Coast where maybe the temperatures are hotter, but it's still significant here too. We still have that increased temperature in stormwater. And then the stormwater goes into the storm drains, and then it increases the water temperature of whatever body of water it discharges into. There was one study in Arlington, Virginia, that recorded an increase in temperature in a nearby river of 8 degrees in only 40 minutes after a heavy summer rain. I mean, that's a huge spike to the fish. And water temperature affects all aspects of aquatic life, especially their metabolism and their reproduction system. And temperature changes of only 2 to 4 degrees can be detrimental to fish. So it doesn't take that 8 degrees that they found in that stream in Virginia. Just a couple of degrees is really significant to fish. And then also, on top of the environmental effects, you have energy consumption. Higher temperatures in the summer increases the energy demand for cooling. And the higher temperatures usually occur in the afternoon, and that's like the peak areas of demand, or the peak demand period times. So EPA thinks that heat island effect is responsible for about 5 to 10% of peak electricity demand for cooling. I mean, that's a lot of extra energy used that we wouldn't have to use if we didn't have the heat island effect. And that during extreme heat events, they're made even worse by the heat islands, so they can overload systems and cause rolling brownouts or blackouts. And then also you get worse air quality. With increasing energy demand results in greater emissions of air pollutants and greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. It's like the harder they have to work, the more pollutants they're emitting out. And higher temperatures also promote the formation of ground level ozone, and that leads to higher ozone emissions during sunny weather. And then, so in addition to the air quality and the other things, it affects us too. The warm days and nights, along with higher pollution levels, can contribute to general discomfort in people. You can have respiratory difficulties, heat cramps and exhaustion, heat stroke, and heat-related mortality. It mainly affects sensitive populations, like children and older adults, or those with existing health conditions. But also the lack of nighttime relief in the air temperature from heat islands is strongly correlated with increased mortality during heat waves. And we don't hear so much about that here in Seattle, but in the Midwest and other places. But it's still a problem here. So now that I've kind of gone through the doom and gloom, you know, some of the harmful effects, I was trying to think about, is it possible that maybe we could change some of our development codes to reduce these heat island effects? But that gets tricky because you really need to balance it between private property rights and development. I mean, you can't stop development. But so I tried to pick a couple of different things, like could we require less parking with development? I mean, our codes require a significant amount of parking for commercial and multifamily properties. But business owners want their patrons to be able to park right outside the business. They don't want them to have to walk a long ways. And residents that live in apartments and condos, they want to be able to park. They don't want to park on the street a block away. They want to be able to park right near where they live. And could we require maybe more vegetation and tree canopy? I mean, we have the tree ordinance that our mayor talked about, and that's really good. But when you have development and the grove of trees is right where they want to put the house, I mean, the trees are going to go. We can't try to keep every tree. And maybe we could require more open space when developing parcels. I mean, now people can usually cover around 50 to 80% of the lots with impervious surface. It's much harder to reduce that heat island effect when you have the small lots and you're covering 50 to 80% of it. And then what about city transportation projects? I mean, we can install street trees, but you still have a large area of hard surface for the streets and the sidewalks and that infrastructure that's really needed by the city. But that all contributes to heat island effect. So one of the things our green building team is going to be looking at this year is looking to see if there's codes we can change, or maybe we can offer incentives. I mean, we don't want to ram a lot of codes down development down for private parties. We want to look for incentives or maybe come up with other ways. And you're going to hear all the other speakers talk about other strategies to reduce heat island. But I was just going to mention that LEED offers, they've already taken this included in their program, and they offer 2 points available to reduce heat island, and it's regarding the roofs and the non-roof surfaces. And they're things like requiring shade for 50% of the hardscape within 5 years of occupancy, using paving materials with solar reflectance index of at least 29 or higher, using open grid paving systems, or placing parking underground or undercover under decks. But then again, those decks need to be some sort of a reflective surface, not the typical stuff. And then vegetated roofs, because then that's the same thing as like a grass, the difference between the sidewalk and a grass lawn. That grass lawn is cooler, and the vegetated roof would be cooler also. So kind of what I want to think about is that traditional development that we've been doing leads to increased heat island effect, and it's detrimental to us and our environment. And hopefully sustainable development seems to be going in the way to limit heat island effect and the adverse impacts, and that's really the way we need to go. And so hopefully with your help, we'll be able to go in that direction. But now Deb's going to come up and talk about trees, talk about the importance of vegetation. Oh, you need the mic.
Yeah. Can everybody hear me? Is it on? Okay. Okay. Well, thanks, Mayor. It's Mayor and Stacy, because we pretty much got it all wrapped up to this point. So, but I'll combine. We're all building from each other, each one of the speakers, and I'll now take a lot of what Stacy said and bring it home to this region and to Kirkland specifically. I'm Deb Powers. I'm the urban forester here for the city of Kirkland. In my background, I started off, well, way back when, in tree care with the city of Seattle. And from then, and some of you know from when I was at the city of Seattle, I was actually the first female lead on a tree crew back in those days. So I went from tree care to becoming a consulting arborist. I've been on the other side of the counter then, writing reports and working with policy and tree retention. And I've been with the city of Kirkland now for a year administering the comprehensive tree regulations here, and regard myself as a natural resource manager here. So I am also an ISA certified arborist, and I'm a member of the International Society of Arboriculture. I'm a certified tree risk assessor and a member of the I got all this. So anyway, Stacy was talking about urban heat island effect as a concept, and we might all wonder what in the Pacific Northwest, how does that affect us? That's an issue for our friends in California or Texas or Florida, where I'm from. And Stacy touched on habitat and why fish and salmon in particular are our canary in the coal mine here. And I wanted to talk about population and rural areas versus urbanized areas. I also have one typo in my presentation, so to keep you guys awake and alert here, whoever can figure that one out gets a free coffee card. So, wake up, these statistics are, so in 1910, half of Washington's population was living in cities. By 2007, 82% of Washington's population was living in cities. That's not too alarming, you know, that just seems pretty average in about 100 years in a century, why people would congregate in urban areas where amenities are and where work is. That's not so alarming. But the projection to the year 2050 is that there would be a 70% increase in Washington's current urban populations. That's quite a projection right there. So you're all not looking for that typo? I'll do the math for you on this one. That additional amount of people that are expected to increase Kirkland's population by 2030 bumps Kirkland to about the same size as the city of Bellingham was last year, to give you an idea of size of cities. That's from current plus this number equals the population of Bellingham is it's a little over 72,000 in 2008. Right. Correct. Right. So that's a listen up to planners and developers and builders and natural resource managers. That in that projection, that 2050, Here's what's interesting. Half of all buildings will have been built in the last 50 years. So what we're doing now is really important in that 2050, when that 70% increase has occurred in urban areas. So that's here in Kirkland in the Puget Sound area. Another one that's not up here is that Oregon and Washington leads the United States in growth. Since 1990, population growth. I don't know if anybody was aware of that. So the point is are we planning and developing and building for the future? And then how this all relates to urban heat island effect and trees and vegetation is that in Kirkland, over 80%, and that's a figure that changes. When I look into that and I research, it goes from everything from 80 to 95%. That's where, where some science could come in to really pinpoint that. But let's just say, over 80%, it's a significant amount of Kirkland's net acreage is privately owned. Has everyone heard of gray infrastructure and green infrastructure? Heard of that term? That's the gray infrastructure. Obviously, what Stacy was talking about, those impervious surfaces that absorb sunlight, converts it to heat, they radiating that heat night and day, and that's what makes the difference. The abnormal temperatures that result in urban heat island effect. In urban areas, that concentration is what's causing this phenomenon. So whether you buy into global climate change, there is probably most everyone sitting in here is not of the camp that doesn't. I would assume, but this is a local phenomenon that is quantified by science. So gray infrastructure versus green infrastructure, and that's what our green infrastructure. When you imagine, close your eyes and you just imagine, okay, all the buildings, all the streets, sidewalks, the street lights, all of that goes away. The mosaic that's left is green infrastructure, or otherwise known as the urban forest. That's interchangeable. And that green infrastructure became a term that's coined more recently because I think there's been a little, there has been quite a bit of more science that's quantifying those environmental benefits that the urban forest can offer. There's a cost that's associated with the engineered equivalent of those environmental benefits. So what the mayor was talking about in the infrastructure that's degrading and needs to be replaced, there's the cost to design and build and maintain all of those systems. So green infrastructure is a fancy-smancy way of saying urban forest or trees and vegetation. And there's another way of just to have you think about too, trees in particular. I heard this in a presentation referred to as solar powered air purifying stormwater managing apparatus. And there's a cost to planting a tree versus designing, engineering, maintaining a stormwater management filtration system. So, and then there's the AK urban forest. So urban heat island mitigation is basically how does this work with trees and vegetation? How is it cooling our urban areas? And just like eighth grade biology, its shade actually is blocking that sunlight from reaching those impervious surfaces so to prevent that heating up and sunlight absorption and evapotranspiration. So ET is, that's nature's air conditioning, basically. Basically through stomata, which is like pores, foliar surfaces emit water vapor, and that is the same as an air conditioner. So in an area adjacent to foliar surfaces, this water vapor that's being released into the atmosphere cools ambient temperature. In city centers, there's a U.S. Forest Service statistics, and evapotranspiration alone accounts for a 9-degree reduction in ambient air temperatures in city centers. So urban heat island mitigation is another way of saying how do trees and vegetation help us? Basically, increasing your trees and vegetation results in all of these, but I want to key in on what Stacy was saying, improved air quality. Because we know that that foliage absorbs pollutants through tree leaves, and that we'll hear more about carbon and carbon sequestration and carbon storage, and it's in our lifetime. Cap and trade carbon will be a commodity that will be regulated. But leaves and foliage surfaces actually improve our air quality by reducing those air temperatures, because pollution goes down when air temperatures go down. Pollution goes up when air temperatures go up, basically. And that reduced pavement maintenance costs. 50% of the life of asphalt can be extended from a study that came out of Berkeley for shaded asphalt. So that's by mitigating. Here's our typo. Come on. What are some strategies for mitigation? What are the Kirkland tree regulations doing now that for that 2050 requiring? Come on, you guys. Look. There's one that's not up there. What can we do now to increase trees and vegetation? Given it. There you go. Plant more, right. So we've got plant more trees and vegetation. Although I just want to mention that the size, required size for trees that we plant in the right-of-way and we plant on private development as part of our tree regulations is a 2-inch caliber tree, or your average tree that you pick up at a nursery to average size to plant in your backyard is a 2-inch caliber tree. It takes 7 to 10 years for that size tree to grow the canopy size that is offering the environmental benefits of canopy that's quantified to mitigate the heat island effect. That contribution's not, it takes 7 to 10 years for that contribution. And these are other, these are other strategies that, like Stacy was saying, we could think about, if not anything else from this series, that we're trying to have some, thought-provoking ideas that we can approach on either side of the counter. Retaining our large canopies where feasible in urban areas is key, besides planting. And protecting our wooded parcels, protecting and maintaining. That's what Green Kirkland Partnership is really key for, doing a lot of what would be declining wooded areas by the ivy infestation and invasives. So protecting and maintaining. And also looking at some of our regulations to see how do they support healthy trees, vegetation, and soils. And that ties into the rest of our presentation as well. So basically, we're trying to open up a discussion or thoughts on sustainable development, where compact growth in a coherent and supportive physical environment is what we want to be thinking about for 2050. So I don't know if anybody has one or two questions, but then we'll go on to the next speaker.
We'll try that. Hi, I'm Matt Miller. I'm with Associated Earth Sciences. We're just down the street here, a local company in Kirkland. We've been in business since about 1986, 1987, doing a lot of work with the master plan developments in the area. That's how we got our start. I'm a senior geotechnical engineer there, and I've been with the Associated Earth Sciences for about 10 years now. So Been working in the area for about 22 years. Got a good handle on the geology. What we're going to try to do on this part of it is kind of go from the trees down to the ground, okay? And as we all kind of know, development in large parcels, it's inevitable. Trees are going to come down. And I'm sorry, Deb, but trees are going to come down. But what we'd like to try to do is introduce some ideas in stormwater management that will allow you to, again, reduce that heat island effect, but still be green and, you know, come up with solutions that, you know, for large developments that are actually going to be green and friendly and good for our stormwater. But first, I'd kind of like to take you back a little bit just to give you a little bit of geology lesson. Real quick, it's always kind of fun for people to see this. I haven't seen it ever before, but this kind of gives you an idea of the glacier that came down. It actually is what creates the geology in the Puget Sound area, okay? So you can see the yellow line here on the side is kind of the extent of the glaciers that came down and pushed south through the Puget Sound area and kind of controlled our geology of the area. Over here on the right, we have the, you know, a depiction of the glacier. Where we're standing was about 3,000 or 4,000 feet of ice at one time. Okay, so what it did in that geology or that glacial period is gave us real unique geologic conditions in the area. Okay, so what we've got are three kind of idealized sections of geology. We've got our recessional outwash, which is material that was deposited as the glaciers were receding to the north. Okay, so it's a loose material. So what we're looking for good infiltration capabilities. Okay, it's a loose material, takes water fairly rapidly. We get infiltration rates up to, you know, 200 to 300 inches an hour we've measured at times. But ideally, you're looking at, you know, 9 to 15 inches an hour is what typically is going to happen. The problem with the recessional outwash is it's usually pretty thin. Okay, so in site development, a lot of times, we get rid of that. And it's something we need to preserve to try to infiltrate. Okay, so in taking into account our site development plans, we need to go out and make a pretty good study of that and find out if we do have any of those areas, how thick it is, and if we can utilize it or not. Because what's below that, it's glacial till. Glacial till was deposited as the glaciers were advancing, okay? So we've got a real compact material. It's got 3,000 to 4,000 feet of ice on it. It's got silt, sand, clay, and boulders in it, okay? So it's a real compact material. Typically, people around here, hardpan, nature's concrete. I mean, it's basically impermeable. We reuse it for earthen dams, material that doesn't infiltrate. And unfortunately, Kirkland has a lot of it. So what we've tried to do is preserve that upper layer. Below that, in a lot of areas is the advanced outwash. Again, a very compact material, but it was deposited as the glaciers were advancing. It's kind of taking that recessional outwash, same type of material, compacting it really hard. But we get these little thin layers of silt in it a lot of times. It impedes vertical flow, but we can still puncture through those silt layers to get horizontal flow through that, and I'll show you some examples of that later. But again, the till around the Kirkland area, it kind of gives you an idea of how we can try to work with the tills that we have around here, but it also kind of gives you an idea of the whole geologic cross-section. What we've got is on top is a weathered zone. Typically in a till, once you get through that topsoil, you've got a weathered zone that's 2 to 3 feet thick, okay? It's a little bit looser. We have a potential of getting some infiltration in that, maybe 1 inch an hour, 2 inches an hour if we're really lucky, okay? But if we're in a site planning stage, we want to maintain that layer, okay? The sidewalk projects we're working on right now up in Juanita area, up in Kingsgate, I think, or just north here on 100th. Those are areas where we can try to preserve that upper till layer or not puncture through it and get a little bit of infiltration. And these sidewalk projects are great for that because we don't have a lot of water going through it. We don't need a lot of storage area. So it's a good example of sidewalk projects with the permeable concrete. Okay, but once we get down to this unweathered till down in this area, it's very low permeability, basically zero. We measure it in inches per year versus inch per hour. So not something we want to try to infiltrate into. So going into a site, large development, more critical, smaller developments, it's much easier to do. But what we're looking for is the geologic soil characteristics of the area, okay? We've got some soil management things we can work with, okay? Larger development, let's take the topsoils from one side of the site, reuse it on the other side. Okay, try to reuse our materials and can be green about not taking away, coming back in. The infiltration potential. Okay, we're going to look around the site. We're going to look for the recessional outwashes or maybe that layer of unweathered till, something of that nature that we can actually get some potential infiltration into. The groundwater conditions, huge issue. Okay, we get that if we do find a recessional outwash, we get the perch groundwater on top of that till. So we need to know that depth if we're going to influence that. We've got analysis called a mounting analysis, where when we infiltrate down, you get this mounting effect underneath your facility where the groundwater doesn't have a chance to go away laterally. Okay, so groundwater is a huge issue there. Your water balance. Let's look for wetlands. Let's look for streams that we're going to maybe take water away from, but also give us opportunities to maybe recharge a wetland, okay? Take stormwater from another area, create a facility, infiltration facility, that may recharge a wetland, okay? Preserve those areas. And then your water supply and springs, things of that nature, are you cutting off somebody else's? Are you trying to maybe influence a water supply for somebody else, okay? So, and those are the things we really need to take care of up in front in the planning stages. So we can take that into consideration where we're putting buildings, where we're stripping material, and try to use some site balance issues. And then again, final site use, okay, is it a commercial site, is it a residential site? Everybody's got their own certain characteristics, but you also need to look at the end user, okay? Is it somebody that's going to maintain that facility? Is it a permeable surface? Do they know about what it is? Okay, we're creating potentially a stormwater facility below grade. Nobody ever sees it. It functions great, but the end user, do they know that it's there? Okay, they need to be put into the CC&Rs of the development. They need to be put into the lease agreements for the commercial users. So those are the things that definitely need to be taken care of and looked at. Okay, real quick, why we infiltrate? We want to mimic the existing condition. Okay, we had a great undisturbed area before, all the ground, all the surface water coming down, going into the ground. Let's play on that on the development. Let's get it back into the ground. Okay, recharge the aquifers. Obviously, we have water issues in this area. Let's put it back in the ground where we can reuse it. And then the big one is preserve open space. Okay, there's your trees, Deb. Let's preserve those trees and reduce the size of these facilities. Okay, so we can preserve that open space. And then again, reduce the heat island effect. Obviously, it's our topic for today. But preserving open space. But if we can create a facility that has an infiltration, we can. I'll show you here in a minute some different things that we can do for the site that we actually do have to clear. Okay. And then again, there's always the lead points. Okay. That's something that you need to take into consideration. So real quick, some typical data requirements that we might want to do prior to a site development. Is there our receptor soil characteristics? Do we have a good infiltration rate that we can use for design facility? We need to have it tested. It's not just good to go out and assume values. Depth of the groundwater table, depth of the aquitards, maybe an aquitard being a constrictive layer that's going to prohibit groundwater from going through. Where's that till at? Hydraulic conductivity, obviously, is kind of a play on the infiltration rate. How fast can we get rid of that water? And then the groundwater flow directions in some areas. Not as big of a deal around this area. A little bit, there's some different ways of getting your infiltration rate. Grain size distribution, we can run a sieve analysis. We can go to our manuals. We can get an infiltration rate. A better way to do that is actually the different types of apparatus that we use typically. These are kind of the old-fashioned methods. Some of the people will still try to use them. The one on the left being the old-fashioned standpipe where we used to go out for the drain fields and get an infiltration rate that way. Too small. Drive it down, you hit a 6-inch rock, you get a 0 infiltration rate, right? Drive it down 6 inches over, you get sand. You got 100 inches an hour, okay? Which one do you use, okay? So we would recommend something a lot bigger. The one on the right there is the double ring, kind of an old-fashioned. But what you want to see, notice here on this, is the amount of water that we're putting in the ground. We're measuring it in, you know, milliliters, okay? Does that mimic the condition that we're doing in a large facility with thousands of gallons of water, okay? So really thinking about what you're using. Typically what we like to do is put it on a broader scale, okay? The one on the left, obviously a much, much larger scale, but the ring that we're using right there is a 6-foot diameter ring, so it gives us a real idea of the area, okay? It's put a lot more water in the ground. We're measuring it in hundreds of thousands of gallons with a water truck, a fire hydrant, whatever, but we're getting a much better representation of the infiltration rate. That's the type of test that I would like to see on a parking lot where we're trying to do a pervious surface. We can use that ring right at the surface and not have to dig a deep hole, and we're putting it where we would actually put water in a parking lot. So we're minimizing our stripping, you know, 6-7 inches to try to get into that weather till zone, and then we can stick that ring right up on top and actually get an infiltration rate. The pit test, more for a facility that's going to be lower in the ground, obviously, for a pond, or if we're actually going to strip to a depth of 3 or 4 feet and actually get down to the surface. Okay. What can we do with that data? Okay. Rain gardens, obviously, something that we can do to reduce our footprint, put water back in the ground. These are some rain gardens that we've worked with out at Snoqualmie Ridge. Put them in the middle of your cul-de-sacs. Great opportunity right there. Along the side of the road, one of the things I want to make sure everybody understands, one of the things that happened on several projects we've had, is that they plant the sod too high at the edge of those runoffs and to get into their bioswales. And that sod layer is, they bring the topsoil up to the top of the pavement, then they put the sod on top of that, and what do you got? It's a little dam right there, okay? Make sure that when they put it in, it's down low enough so it actually flows into these biofiltration facilities. Should be noted on the plans, hopefully. Okay, a rain garden there on the right. This one actually was a special deal where we actually had decent infiltration up at the top, but we wanted to get the water deeper in the ground. And then I talked about the advanced outwash unit that actually has these silt layers in it that would restrict vertical flow. So some of the things you can do to try to get water in the ground when you do have limited infiltration is dig what we call a UIC drain, which is an underground contraction control. Okay, that allows the water to get deeper in the ground quicker and dissipate much quicker. That's going to put these in the ground to reduce the size of a footprint of a pond. We can put them in rain gardens to allow more water to be put in there, freeing up space. It gets water deeper in the ground, and it's going to enhance potentially a pond or a trench performance. This is a typical UIC drain. These were actually done for Suncadia over in eastern Washington. But actually, what we put these in line with the catch basins, okay? Each individual catch basin had these pits dug underneath them to allow stormwater to get down below. I wasn't involved that much in the project, but from what I understand, it's 7,000-acre development. They still didn't have enough room for ponds, so we had to put it back on the ground down deep. Okay, just another tool in the toolbox to try to get water back in the ground. Another way is, so an elementary school project we worked on, an existing facility had no place really to put water. They needed to minimize the footprints. These school projects are one of the, their land is valuable. They're trying to bring everything down as small as they can. So we're reducing the size of their facility by putting it deep. So this one actually is that there's a pipe that went up on top of this. And it seeped down through the bottoms through those pits that are about 3 foot in diameter and are filled with rock, able to reduce the size of that whole facility. This is kind of what I'm talking about with the recessional out or the advanced outwash. You get these silt layers in here that will actually impede vertical flow. The next one would be is permeable surfaces. Okay, lots of stuff out there. A lot of trade names, a lot of different things. What I've got here is some. Yeah, that'll work. What you've got at the top is a permeable surface, right? So what you have to do is create a subgrade that's going to take that water, okay? So you've got your porous surfacing, whether it's grass paved, permeable concrete, permeable asphalt, sitting at the top. And you've got a storage layer. So what you're doing is creating a detention system, basically, within that storage layer. This crushed rock layer has got about 30% voids in it, okay? So that creates a lot of storage for that water. So depending upon the infiltration rate of what you have down below in your native subgrade, determines the thickness of that storage layer up on top. Okay, that's something the civil engineer comes up with. We'll give them the design parameters for it, but the civil engineer actually comes up with that thickness. Just a few different types of things. There's pavers. There's your concrete blocks, basically bricks with voids in them. They're backfilled around the pore spaces with crushed rock, whether it's peat gravel, something that has a high void ratio. Grass pave and gravel pave. I think the home there on top is actually featured in the Daily Journal of Commerce recently. That's the Kirkland House, the grass paved driveway. So basically, we put down the matrix down here of that's a high density polyethylene grid system. They actually can either fill them with gravel and have a gravel surface, or you can put the sod layer in there and plant grass, and actually it's a driving surface. Or you can do the same thing. With these, and there's a different kind with those with concrete, actually can grow grass in them too, and I believe that's what the house is. Permeable concrete has been coming up in popularity here in the last several years. Great for high traffic areas, parking lots for, this actually is the Snoqualmie ice cream out in Maltby, where they have the entire parking lot in permeable concrete. I'm a huge advocate of this, and the sidewalk projects we're working on for Burien, for SeaTac, for City of Kirkland, I mean, City of Bellevue, they're all a great use of this because you're creating these new sidewalks in these areas that don't have sidewalks. Basically, if you put a pervious concrete sidewalk down, it's a net zero increase of impervious surface, so stormwater helps out a bunch. Pervious asphalt, another one that we're not seeing a lot of around here yet. They're still trying to gain in popularity. It was a little bit cheaper before all the oil prices went way up, so it's kind of comparable in price now with the concrete. This is a project I worked on up in Marysville, and talk about heat island effect and kind of green building. This is probably how you make kind of a little bit of lemonade out of lemons, I guess it is. With a 42-acre parking lot, we made it pervious, so there's our LID for that one. Oops, that's David. Couple missing. That's okay. Like, I knew it. There was too many slides and he cuts them out. That's all right. Anyway, this one actually is really good, just to kind of give you a little bit of the final user on these things. We had a restaurant up here, a burger chain, and they didn't realize that actually it was a permeable surface, and they're out there with the pressure hoses and grease racks, and they had sprayed all the burger racks out, and all the grease from the burgers had flowed out over the parking lot and sealed up a pretty substantial area of the permeable asphalt. So, again, your final user and letting them know what's going on there. The other one, too, was the heat island effect. There's a great slide of how it actually, if you're getting water back through a permeable pavement section, once you do get heat, that the evapotranspiration coming back up through is a reduction. It's a pretty significant reduction in heat island effect with a permeable surface. So something to think about. Some more tools for the toolbox and the stormwater. Mr. Hilgers, I think, believe it's your turn.
I have one electronic device in my pocket here. All
right. Everybody hear me? Everything's cool? All right. Where's our mouse? Here we go. Okay, so my name's David Hilgers. I'm a landscape architect with Triad Associates. A little higher. Hold up. Is that better? Right. Well, this thing is backwards on my shirt here, so I can't get it on because it's backwards on my shirt. There we go. Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. I could probably speak loud enough without it, but again, I'm David Hilgers. I'm a landscape architect, LEED accredited professional. I'm going to talk a little bit about sustainable site development techniques and kind of to tie that in with heat island effect and how we can do some of these techniques to reduce the heat island effect. So I have four main topics that I'm going to focus on, and that is using the LEED new construction rating system to kind of use it as a parameter for a case study that I'm going to look at, which is Danielson Grove, which is a cottage-style housing development right here in Kirkland. And using the sustainable site section of the LEED checklist and the typical credits that are in there, and how the project didn't go after LEED, but it really had met the intents of those credits within LEED. So it's a good parameter to kind of give you some context for it. Then I'm going to switch gears and talk about siding structures for solar orientation, and then tie that in with green roofs and heat island effect. So looking at the LEED for new construction rating system, and this is the version 2.2, which is the newest one now. They're rolling out 2009, which will kind of tweak this a little bit. But right now, LEED for new construction version 2.2 is the most current. And the site selection credit within the sustainable... How many of you are familiar with this rating system? How many LEED APs do we have here? Okay, so quite a few. This particular portion of the section of the new construction manual focuses on site selection, site development as far as connectivity with the surrounding community, transportation issues, making sure you're connected with transportation, trying to enhance walkable communities and create those type of communities. It also talks about heat island effect specifically, and then it focuses on stormwater as well. So those are all kind of within this section of that particular portion of LEED. So the site selection credit really focuses on avoiding what's called a greenfield, which is really an undeveloped site or a site that is farmland, ag land. It's got some critical areas within it. It tries to focus on not developing those sites. And if you do need to develop it, trying to reduce that footprint within the development of that site. The next credit is development density and community connectivity. This really tries to focus on channeling the development within urban areas. So if you're within the city of Kirkland, you know, you're kind of in an urban area already, but looking at maybe sites that are possibly an infill site, that's previously developed site, something that you can possibly come in and upgrade that site, maybe deconstruct what's on the site currently, reuse those materials, and build a new facility. And then we also look at density, trying to up that density. And with the case study that I'm looking at, Danielson Grove, you'll see how the density was bumped up within this site. The surrounding kind of mature neighborhood really has a lot lower density, but you'll see how this fits seamlessly within there, and you don't really see this huge building right bam right in front of you with a surrounding mature neighborhood. So it really did a good, successful job of doing that. And then pedestrian access as well, providing access to amenities throughout the site that are nearby where you may not need to get into your car to get there. Credit 4 is the alternative transportation. Looking at access to public transportation and trying to make sure that your development has that access so you don't have to get into a car if not needed, and to maybe have a bus stop nearby or some light rail nearby if possible. It really looks at encouraging bicycles and walking, trying to connect with regional trails that are nearby, provide walking trails and paths that can get you to amenities around the area. Encourage alternative and low emission fuels, which is kind of a tricky one, and LEED addresses this one by providing preferred parking for alternative fuel vehicles or encouraging the development of electrical charging stations within the development and trying to let those cars be plugged in right there with a right in front parking spot, or trying to even install a biofuel station within the site, which could be pretty tricky and quite costly, but they're trying to encourage this type of development. Protection and restoration, the Sustainable Sites Credit 4, or 5, excuse me, really focuses on limited site disturbance. So if you have a site that has some pristine areas in it, can you focus that development on a different part of the site and try to protect and restore these areas? If you do need to take out some trees, which sometimes happens in development, you know, if you can go in and restore that area to pre-development conditions, is a benefit. And also maximizing open space. So if you can provide a really efficient design where you can maximize open space. And I think Danielson Grove does a good job of showing that. So let's take a look at that a little closer. So Danielson Grove is a cottage company project, which is a cottage type development using the City of Kirkland's innovative housing ordinance. Cottage development, the homes are a lot smaller. We're talking about 1,500 square feet max for any of the homes in here. There's 16 homes on a 2.5 acre site. This is an infill site. And you see, that's just about 6.5 homes per acre in density, which is a lot higher than the surrounding neighborhood. So when we see some of the photos here that I'm going to get into, you can see how this was done, yet you don't really drive by and go, wow, look at that. There's tons of homes packed on that site. So it's really well done as far as the site design and the layout. Existing vegetation and protection, the big key here is there was a lot of mature trees on the site, fir trees, cedar trees, you know, some of them 100 feet tall. And if we can integrate that design and provide that housing, yet still have those trees and providing the benefit that we've seen they do, I think that's an advantageous thing to do. And then natural drainage techniques. So I didn't talk about the specific credit within LEED, but this uses natural drainage techniques such as bioretention to reduce the amount of stormwater the city needs to deal with and manage down the line. So let's get to the good stuff here, some pictures. So this is a site plan. Rendered up site plan of Danielson Grove. To get you oriented, north is up, and we have 128th Avenue Northeast, which is this main road all the way to your left of the slide. First, talking about parking, some of the techniques on this was to provide, there's no garages for these buildings here, and no driveways for the homes within this main area. There are some garages for the homes up on the upper area, but they're rather minimal. So the parking is down here, right in here. Here's some garages and some parking areas here. So everybody parks there and then walks to their home. So this creates some community. So you have to get out of your car and actually walk into your home, and you have to interact with your neighbors. You see your neighbors. Everybody fronts on a major open space there, which is a large grass area in the middle. The parking areas that are provided are open grass-filled pavers. So where there is parking provided, we've tried to reduce that impervious surface by using open grass-filled pavers there. And without having the driveways and all of that, you can see how this efficient use of the land, we're able to bump up the density. We're able to provide a community open space, which everybody uses and enjoys. So it reduces impervious surface, and it also reduces lawn area, which people might have to maintain, fertilize, water, and all of those things that go into that. The large trees that are shown in here were mature fir and cedar trees that were all protected and saved. So we're going to get into some pictures here to show you exactly the development here and see how that worked. So this picture shows the community lawn area, and this building in the back is the community gathering space. It's kind of the rec area for this community. So you can see all the buildings front right on this open space. It's kind of their front lawn, and it's shared and used by everybody. So it's a really efficient layout. So you can see that by packing this in and really creating a community, it can kind of take advantage of the land and still allow you to protect some of the areas that are native. So this is a good photo that shows some of the large native trees that were protected. And the thing to note here is all of the understory here, this whole area was roped off and no machinery was allowed in there. The forest duff that's there is what was there before development. And this was just hand grubbed out and replanted with some native species, some salal and some sword ferns. And then we used walkways that came through. In this case was gravel, so we didn't have any impact with hardscape in that. Where we did need a hardscape path within existing tree areas, we used porous paving. So we reduced the impervious surface, helping with stormwater runoff, helping with heat island effect, and also helping retain these trees and not disturb the root systems that are underneath that sidewalk. Here's a picture of the parking areas next to one of the garages. This is the garage building here, and these are visitor parking spaces right here that were provided on site. There's about six spaces, I believe, all of them using the grass-filled paver. This picture shows the bioretention swales that are between the homes. So all of the homes, the gutters and downspouts kick the water down into a swale between the homes, which then runs down the swale and is collected in a basin, and then that basin kicks it into the stormwater detention vault, which was greatly reduced in size due to the infiltration and the biofiltration that's happening here in the swales. So all the homes were able to do that. I talked to Linda Pruitt, who's the owner of Cottage Company and developer. She recently went out there, looked at the vault with some maintenance, and basically it seemed bone dry. Like they weren't getting much water in there at all. So I think these swales are being very successful. So this is another angle of that made an open space showing the plaza. The detention vault actually sits underneath this plaza. So we were able to take that stormwater detention area and turn it into an amenity and maximize open space. So we have dual functions there. This last slide really shows this is right on the main street frontage. This is the community building here. It really shows how it fits within the neighborhood. I think when you drive by this, you know, a lot of developments, you see the entry sign. There's a big, monolithic sign to introduce the development, and here it stands out. And that really kind of sticks out in a lot of areas. You know, an infill site like this in a mature neighborhood, I think this kind of downplayed entrance really works well. And it fits within the mature trees, and it really doesn't stick out at you. But when you walk in there, it's very aesthetically pleasing, it's very efficient, and it really creates a nice neighborhood. So now I want to switch gears a little bit here and talk about siding structures with solar orientation and taking advantage of the sun in the winter to soak up that heat and trying to orient the structure to kind of block out the summer heat that can be soaked up in a building And just start out with a figure here and some stats. We have buildings consume 75% of electricity in the United States. 50% of that energy use is to heat and cool the building. So if you can just simply take advantage of the sun, you probably reduce that number quite a bit and make a large impact. And we do this by siting structures to passively capture that winter sun and reduce the amount of summer exposure. We also use other techniques such as overhangs, glazing in the windows, placement of those windows, trees, and thermal massing. I'll talk about thermal massing here in a bit. So this graphic shows really well how to orient a building. It also kind of makes it look really simple. You know, it's a nice wide open picture. There's no obstructions. It's not an infill site or anything. It's just very easy. But it, really the context of it is to orient the broad side of the building towards the south. So you get that low winter sun that can come right in some windows, soak up into the building, and keep that heat in there. It also has the shorter side of the building on the east-west axis, so that high summer sun is really only hitting the shortest side of the building. But you can see how a challenge that would be in a development, even in like a Danielson Grove, where you have a lot of homes in a small area. How do you orient them? It's an infill lot that has some pretty set boundaries. We have existing trees. So this is a really challenge just to simply make this happen. You really have to look at your site design carefully. So kind of zooming in a little bit and seeing how this works in detail, you can see with the higher summer sun is being blocked by some overhangs at the very top, yet the lower window or the lower winter sun can get into that window, bounce off some internal walls. Those internal walls soak up some heat. It then gets down to the floor. That floor soaks up heat as well. On the lower windows here on the edge, we have summer sun again with overhangs being blocked, yet the lower winter sun can get in there. And then with the thermal massing, if you have a floor space that's being exposed to the sun, let's say that floor is a concrete floor. Concrete has a really good thermal mass to it, and it can soak up a lot of heat. And what happens, and what was explained earlier in some of the early presentations in Heat Island, is all that heat is then radiated back as temperatures in the air surrounding that get cooler. It's all through a process called conduction, where heat transfers from the higher energy and higher heat areas always transfers to the cooler areas. So as the air cools in the house, that heat from the thermal mass then collects into the home. So that's kind of the process that's at work here. So if you can take advantage of that, which is just a natural process, it can really help reduce some of that energy load of heating and cooling the home. And then if you combine that with a green roof, so if you take solar orientation, combine that with a green roof, can really take advantage of the sun as well as the insulating properties of soil. So you have the orientation, you're collecting that winter sun, yet you still have a roof that's exposed to the heat of the summer sun. Well, you put a green roof on that, you've really made a difference. So the roof is where the greatest amount of heat is gained in the summer and lost during the winter. So if you can insulate that better, you can make a large impact. The benefits and results of a green roof providing the soil provides the insulation. You then reduce the energy for heating and cooling. The plants provide evapotranspiration. As we heard earlier, it really provides a lot of cooling effects with evapotranspiration. And that also has some air quality benefits as well as stormwater management benefits that we've seen. Now I just want to kind of wrap up my presentation with some nice pictures. It's always the best way to end. And this is some urban areas, and then the last pictures I'm going to show are more of a residential application. But this is the Justice Building in Seattle. You can see it's very aesthetically pleasing, yet it's also providing a great deal of benefit for heating and cooling within the building, as well as reducing the heat island effect within that urban area. We have another type of urban green roof. This one's more of a garden roof, which, you know, typically in a long time ago, before green roofs were really thought of in the United States, you know, we do these garden areas on a deck and a patio of a building in the urban area. It really is a green roof. I mean, it's the same thing. It's providing the same benefits as a green roof. It's very aesthetically pleasing and provides a lot of usable space for pedestrians and open space within the building. So, you know, this is kind of a more deep and intensive way to do it. But I think that this is really providing the same benefits as a green roof. I put this slide in here. This is the Ballard Library to show how maintenance is important, for one. They ran out of money to really maintain this particular facility, and they just kind of let it go. But what's happening here is it may not look as good as some of the other green roofs, But it's still providing the function. We still have the insulating properties of the soil that are doing their job. The plants probably aren't evapotranspirating as well because I think they're dead. So it doesn't really work as good. But I imagine this will probably come back. This is a winter photo, and I imagine this will come back. Some of these plants will come back in the spring and summer. Some of the species in grasses are just meant to brown out, and then they come back. And then to kind of look at a residential application, this is the Going Green at the Beach project that's up in Stanwood. David and Anna Porter, who built this home, we put this pretty small green roof element on an overhang to a patio, and then the main panels that you're looking at there are right above a reading den. And the owners have told me that the building, the room right above this actually gets pretty warm. It gets a lot of sun. It soaks right up in there. But the room right under this green roof kind of has a basement feel to it. It really has a nice cooling feel in that room. So they like to sit in there and hang out.
How steep is that room?
This pitch, I believe, was 2 to 12. Yeah, the angle's a little weird. We're up from another area looking down on it. But you can see where I'm standing on the roof right there.
Yeah.
It's not really that steep. And these are trays that are brought in, two-foot by two-foot trays. So it's a modular system, which works really well for a residential application. And then my last slide, I just wanted to kind of leave you. This is a zero-energy house that's being built on the west slopes of Lake Sammamish right now. And the scope that I'm involved in and Triad's involved in is the green roof as well as a rainwater harvesting system. We're again going to be using the modular tray system. But the whole goal of this home is to just try to achieve zero energy, try to get off the grid entirely. And you need to use all of these techniques in conjunction. You have a windmill, we have solar panels, we have structural insulated panels, we have insulated concrete forms, the green roof, rainwater harvesting, all of these things come together to try to meet zero energy and get off of the grid. So that's kind of the goal of this project. I think it's going to be done here in another month or so. Public tours will probably be open after that. So if you're interested in seeing that, you can let me know and I can try to hook you up to get out there for a tour. And that's it for me. Thank you very much.
David, are they actually trying to get off the grid or just produce as much as they use?
Well, they're trying to produce as much as they use. Yeah, they're actually hoping to give back to the grid. So, yeah, I misspoke a little bit there. Yeah. All right, thank you. Yes.
Well, now's the time that all of you can ask the burning questions. And got one in the back.
David here. How much stormwater is captured by a green roof?
How much stormwater is captured by a green roof? Well, that's a
complex question.
How thick is the roof? How big is the roof? Huh? You know, I mean, that's you have to calculate that. It's been shown through studies, and actually, if you want to see some good data, go to the City of Portland's website, their Department of Environmental something, and they have, I mean, it's incredible the amount of data they've actually collected through monitoring a green roof. A couple of the green roofs that they've monitored, they've shown like an 80% reduction in volumes of the water hitting the roof then collecting through the downspouts and actually getting down into the gutters. And it depends on the thickness of that green roof and also the plants that are on.
John?
Yeah. What, David, what kind of costs are we looking at this time period
for
the demonstration project on Lake Sammamish?
Yeah. Well, it's not cheap. It's definitely higher than your average single-family home, especially like a spec home. I think specifically for the green roof, the tray is like a 2-foot by 2-foot tray. You can look at about $25 a square foot for the soil, the tray, and the plants. That doesn't include installation.
And the structural for it?
The structural for it is also going to increase your cost because you're going to have about 0.6 pounds per square foot of saturated weight for that soil with the plant material as well. So you're going to need to bump up that structural integrity of the home. Definitely work with your structural engineer.
Another strategy that doesn't get all of the effects of a green roof, but is to actually adjacent to the house to build a stormwater, kind of a, it looks just like a planter, and they call it a stormwater planter, but the water can come off the roof and slowly infiltrate, and usually there's some kind of overflow device if there's too much water, but that also can help on the infiltration side, and that's not nearly as expensive, but you don't get all the insulation effects. And I think that, I want to say the Shoreline Library has a really good example of that.
Also something to keep in mind, if you do all this stuff, the utility bills are a lot less, and that much more per month that you can put on your mortgage.
That's true.
That's true sustainability.
And that's where you have to, I also have to put in a plug that you really need a good designer involved in the project, because there's a lot of things that can go wrong. And I bet David's got some lessons learned.
Yeah, one thing is, it's all this stuff is new, and there's new innovations happening all the time. I mean, I don't think anybody can sit there and say that they're an expert at this. I mean, we're constantly learning. I've done some projects. I would not claim I'm an expert. I know a lot because I've done it and made mistakes, but I'm not an expert. I'm learning on the way as well.
That's a, yeah, in the Pacific Northwest, that's a mixed bag with native plants. When they're functioning, this, we may go back and forth on this, but it depends on what they're being used for as far as functioning. There's this assumption that native plants are better, but it depends on what for. In the slide that had, well, the cottage project, that the understory was within a mature Douglas Western Red Cedar Grove, that was the most appropriate use of native plant selection. When it comes to infiltration or the function for stormwater, 100% native plants may not be the way to go. So I would say it really has to do with whatever the function of that area is, in deciding whether it should be all native plants or partially. But.
Another question. They want the street trees, you know, they want the pavement all in one block, the trees separated, rather than getting the tree canopy, you know, mixed in. Is there any convincing data out there that we can...
We could use a public works person. Really, I would say off the top of my head is probably the best model for street tree placement and offsetting urban heat island effect is in Europe, where there are large canopied street trees that are providing those benefits and not necessarily in the same layout that in the States that is typical, with this very linear, very straight, very you know, offset by homes that are very close to the street. I think we're getting back to pre-World War II layout for pushing those houses back, farther back, that allow for streets and wider yards and street trees that are closer to those asphalted areas to provide that cooling. We're also, I think, getting a little more progressive with meandering and bumping sidewalks and accommodating larger trees for the canopy to provide those benefits. So it's a cultural thing, I think, that we're just like everything else here, we're in trying to stay ahead of the curve. We might have to look at other places and see how other people are doing that.
Yeah,
to change.
I'd add a little bit to that as well. As a landscape architect that's designed a lot of street tree locations, a lot of times the code with a particular spacing that says 25 foot on center, 30 foot on center, if you're doing a housing development, typically what will happen is the trees are secondary. They're second important to the utilities, the driveways, the curbs, the streets, anything else. They're basically the bottom of the pole. So those get kicked aside as much as possible to provide all those utilities and amenities that are needed. But we need to find a balance and find a way to bump the importance of the trees up. And then maybe be a little flexible on the spacing, because there's so many conflicts with utilities and driveways and curb cuts that it's almost impossible to meet that spacing. You need to be a little flexible with that and have some imagination on how we lay out that design of the street tree. And maybe have a little bit more flexibility with how close they can be to certain utilities. So it's a balance, and it's tough to meet that balance, but I think it's something that trees need to be more important and thought of more importantly.
And I would add, getting buy-in from your officials is really important. And, like, just getting them to training sessions, like King County does Green Tools. And I've seen a lot of inspectors come to those sessions. And I've seen them come back to the city and engage with, say, the green building team members or asking questions and stuff like that. And so sometimes education can wear down that barrier and create curiosity. And, you know, I think that's happened here at City of Kirkland. So if you can get those folks to these sessions, it'd be great. Derek.
Aspects there are, then they can consider fully all of the values and make a decision right here.
I think part of it comes down to also when you're making those decisions, your community values the trees in theory. And the engineers have lots of good hard dollar figures. So, you know, looking for what I'm looking for is some good figures and examples of. But if we move the trees here, we can reduce the heat by certain percentages. Then, you know, and that's been done here. And they end up with a better product in the end. Kind of bring the value of the trees up to the savings of moving them back here.
Hey, that brings up a good point. If I could, and probably the biggest
really good point in the beginning, and that is sustainable design. So it's a lot harder sometimes to quantify than it is to look at the cost of the day of doing a job. So in traditional design and build, a lot of times we operate in silos. And what's the most efficient way for one silo has a detrimental effect many times on the other silos. So if we can figure out a way, and I challenge all of you, because you're all planning and engineering professionals, I challenge you to look more at how do I explain the long-term effects, the long-term cost and benefits of doing things maybe a more sustainable way.
I actually have two questions. One should be pretty easy. They're more directed toward Matt.
She's a geologist.
I love geology, but I'll try not to talk it too much. This one's, are there streets other than at High Point that are made of porous concrete around the area?
There are. High Point is probably the most high profile. As far as public streets,
I found that there is a lack of that because of the maintenance issues. The problem people are, the public works people are concerned about going back in and doing utility work if they have to and cut the streets. The other issue is maintenance. They don't necessarily have the equipment to maintain them on a frequent basis, because you do have to vacuum versus sweep. Okay, as far as the ditching and the saw cutting, what I've talked to a lot of the professionals about is, you know, what if you take out a 2 foot wide strip in the middle of the street, you're really not affecting right. the overall capabilities of the entire street width. Okay, so yes. it's an insignificant amount that's becoming impermeable. You can still patch it with permeable. I think that is probably one of the biggest misnomers. But I think the other thing is concern about maintenance, and I think we're starting to work through that a little bit with a lot of these sidewalk projects. And I think once they see the benefits of that, you're going to see more. I know City of Bellevue right now, we was on a team that looked at 108 down south of Bellevue Way and creating the bike lanes. There's no curb and gutter there now, but they're putting in bike lanes, and all the bike lanes are going to be concrete, which it provides two things. It's a net zero increase in the storm runoff because it's going back in the ground, but you're also providing almost a designated lane in itself, just with a different material. So I think
Visually it's separate. Yeah. My second question is in the functioning of the porous concrete itself. Mm-hmm. So say you have a situation where you've got the weathered soil, and then closely underneath that, you're running into the till layer. Mm-hmm. And then who knows what's down below that. But when you install the porous concrete, you might have some drainage in there, but thinking about the precip coming down on the porous concrete, it acts as if it's not there. So why would one have to ditch a lot underneath it and backfill with a lot of material? Couldn't you just let it function?
If you're trying to infiltrate it, you need to create that storage to get it down in there. Otherwise, in a pre-developed condition, it was either absorbing it or it was running off somewhere else. Okay, if you're right. trying to solely put it back in the ground, you need to provide enough storage, theoretically, to hold it there long enough for it to infiltrate in that material that you took down.
But wouldn't your concrete profile, depending on, say, you do 5-6 inches of porous concrete and maybe with an inch or two of drain rock underneath it, depending on what your precip for the area is, wouldn't that also hold water to an extent in the pore spaces, so evapotranspiration could occur as well?
Yes, and I would agree to that. There is some adhesion, so to speak, but the infiltration rate through a porous concrete is about, I think they measured it, 300-400 inches an hour.
Yeah.
So it goes through pretty quick. It's just going to be what actually it's through adhesion is going to stay there, and then you get that evapotranspiration. And there's storage in that.
Right.
Even if you've only got a certain amount of storage at the bottom, it's going to fill up to the top potentially, then it's going to run off. But if you are going to go down and hit a till layer, you really need to look at the offset impacts also, because what you've got is going out into an existing jet, potentially you're into a private residence area, sloping area, old fill. Other thing too, if you're adding on to these sidewalks, is you need to provide separation for that exact issue you're talking about. You've got a pervious sidewalk that is right. now designed to infiltrate and has a subgrade to take that, but you've also got the old road section that wasn't designed to be saturated. So if you get infiltration on the side, it's going to go laterally into your existing paving section. It's not designed to be saturated. There could be some issues. So the ones that I've done with the sidewalks, we actually put up almost an impermeable barrier between the two to go lateral to the outside or to go think about that. So
I don't mean to cut you off, but I want to honor everybody's time, and I'd like to thank all the speakers and Brenda for coming today and giving a really great presentation. I'm sure a lot of folks are going to stick around for a little while, so if you've got some burning questions, feel free to approach them if you can stay for a couple minutes, but can you just thank them? Bye.
Water. You kind of got the big picture today, and it's the top things that we found separating this to hour and a half session, everything in sustainability is interrelated. So we can kind of put that box together, but it still, there's overlap between the different sessions. So anyway, we will be back here next month. Love to see all of you. Also would love feedback on the program, what we can do better. And we're willing to work with other cities if you're interested in doing it. So thank you.